This episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast, is brought to you in partnership with Thermo Fisher Scientific. Thermo Fisher's cell therapy processing instruments are designed to help customers transition from process development to commercial manufacturing, utilized as standalone devices or integrated as part of a closed modular process. Thermo Fisher Scientific recommends Gibco CTS DynaSelect Magnetic Separation System, which is a next-gen cell isolation and activation instrument. Gibco CTS Xenon Electroporation System allows customers full control to optimize for a variety of cell types and payloads. And Gibco CTS Rotea Counterflow Centrifugation System is a closed cell processing system supporting a broad range of protocols for cell separation, washing, and concentration. Customers can rely on and streamline their drug development process with Applied Biosystems QualTrack qPCR and dPCR quality control tools for robust and reliable genetic analysis across various phases of drug development, supported by relevant, compliant documentation. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Harris, and I'm joined by RegenxBio's CEO, President, and Director, Ken Mills. RegenxBio is a clinical stage biotech currently developing gene therapy product candidates for the treatment of retinal, metabolic, and neurodegenerative diseases. So, Ken, welcome. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Absolutely. So, I want to talk a little bit about certainly the Affinity Duchenne trial of RGX-202. So just recently at the annual International Congress of the World Muscle Society, RegenxBio announced additional interim safety data and initial efficacy data for the phase 1-2 Affinity Duchenne trial of RGX-202 for the treatment of Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so I was hoping you and I could talk a little bit about the results and the updates that was shared that were shared at the event.
Yeah, I love that. I think that this is an exciting week for us because this is a program and a commitment that we made to Duchenne that we announced in early 2021, but really some scientific work for us started just about 2 or 3 years ago. And this is the first ever efficacy data that we've been able to show in the first two boys that have received our treatment, which is called RGX-202. And we were really pleased to report early signs of improvement with respect to how the drug is working and some early evidence clinically that there's the potential for us to change the trajectory of disease for these young boys. There's context here, Aaron. This year, in fact, just a few months ago, was the first ever approval of an AAV gene therapy product for Duchenne boys. And we're really pleased about that as well, because it was something that we had hoped for, and that in 2021, when we announced our program, we really leaned into. We thought that AAV as a gene therapy modality was the right class of medicines to provide treatment options for boys with Duchenne. And we wanted to get involved in that. But there were some people ahead of us, and some of their data actually influenced our thinking. I think what has happened in the last couple of months, and even including our readouts yesterday, is that treatments have become available on an access basis to more boys and families. The FDA has sort of made it known that there's a pathway for approval for these types of treatments. And with Regenix's report on data yesterday, we've shown that improvements that we've made scientifically in manufacturing might translate into better outcomes. Potential for improvement based on things even that were just recently approved. So the other thing that we announced is we're so excited that we're going to move forward as quickly as possible to try to get on track with respect to our own later stage studies, pivotal phase, to set us up for an approval. And that really has been a testament to, I think, the vision and the work by the team, but also just what's been going on with other stakeholders in the environment as well. And again, I sort of attribute FDA's decision for the first accelerated approval of an AAV gene therapy, specifically in Duchenne, to be a meaningful contribution to that.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I think we can't wait to see what's next and all the progress you've made. So certainly we'll come back and talk about it even more once additional progress has been made. We just wrapped up our most recent Cell and Gene Live, which featured your colleague and your CEO, Curran Simpson. He was one of our expert panelists, and I really encourage all of our listeners to go and view that 60-minute panel on demand. We talked a lot about the future of viral vectors, and it was an excellent presentation, and Curran delivered some really valuable information that I think you're going to want to listen to. So definitely check that out. And like I said, the 60-minute presentation focused on the future of viral vectors. And so I wanted to get your take, Ken, on where AAV is headed broadly in the next handful of years. And what will these improvements and the evolutions mean for other cell and gene companies who are listening to this episode?
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to have Curran as part of a panel. He's such a great leader, both in biotech and in cell and gene therapy, where he joined us in 2015 and has continued to make meaningful contributions with just great experience and knowledge. I think my view of where we are with respect to cell and gene therapy, particularly on the not just the clinical development side, where in the last several years, we've seen definitely an accelerated pace of more therapies being presented to FDA for consideration for licensure. It was only 6 years ago, really, where the first AAV gene therapy was approved. Other forms of gene therapies were also starting to pick up steam then. But I think in the last 6 months, there have been three AAV gene therapies approved. So, from 2017 over a maybe 5 or 6 year period, that interval and time and place between product approvals has increased. And I think that's largely supported by more resource, more capital, more people involved. I think the science foundationally has always been in place since we became a public company in 2015. We've been sharing a lot of our technology under licenses, under partnership, which has really helped spur on the field. But it definitely has been something that has needed investment in manufacturing and supply chain as well. I think the need for that from us specifically comes from the fact that we believe AAV gene therapy has a real potential in very, very large indications as well, not just in small, rare, and orphan indications. And I'll give you an example of that. As I alluded to, the first AAV gene therapy approved in 2017 was for a blindness disease that often presents in children or maybe young adults. And it's an inherited condition that's pretty rare. FDA approved that treatment on a pretty small trial evaluation, but one that was run, I think, in a really thoughtful way about how to sort of improve vision in these patients. And, it was a gene replacement technology, but probably on a worldwide basis, we're talking about hundreds, maybe low thousands of people that, might suffer from that condition of blindness. The technology was probably there 10 or 15 years ago to support a product like that. When Regenix became a company that was focused on drug development and we went public, we focused on the largest indication, I think, all of AAV gene therapy, the most common form of blindness, something called age-related macular degeneration, where there's millions of patients, where I think the market potential starts at hundreds of thousands. And so to be able to go from something that was meant for, maybe a few hundred patients to something that is a few hundred thousand to millions needed a lot more technical advances in sort of the quality, the yields, the scalability of manufacturing. And so I think we've been a leader in that. We've made contributions to that. And a lot of it has come, if I reflect on it, from people in biotech that have done that before with other modalities like protein therapeutics or antibody therapeutics. That's certainly Curran's background and the background of a lot of people at Regenix Bio who have been involved in scaling processes and scaling science for industry. And so while some of the early technology components were there scientifically for AAV gene therapy, even 10 years ago, it was maybe 5 years ago or less where I think really Regenix Bio and other companies got to a place where we can scale these therapies for millions of patients. And That's what the future holds. I think gene therapy is going to become something that is more familiar to more different types of conditions and medical communities and patient communities than we've seen in the last 5 years. And I think there's going to be exponential growth there.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and certainly if the webinar, the Cell and Gene Live that I mentioned earlier that Curran was a part of, we talk all about that specifically. So what you're saying here echoes exactly our sentiment that was shared in that webinar too. So it's been a few years since the first gene therapy using your NAV technology, so that's NAV, was approved by the FDA for the treatment of spinal muscular atrophy. So bring us up to speed on the NAV technology and how is it being utilized now?
Yeah, that was an amazing event to see, a technology that we had been involved with start to change the lives of patients at a commercial scale. And that was our AAV9 vector, which was approved in 2019. We continue to use that vector, I think, in a lot of important and meaningful diseases. And we actually at Regenxbio have plans to file our first BLA or biological license application with the FDA using that same NAV AAV9 vector next year in 2024 for another condition called Hunter syndrome. So, there's been some leverage of the technology and the first approval across other disease indications, even in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, another area that we're operating in. As I mentioned, we just talked about our data. Also, other companies are using the technology and our technology. In fact, Pfizer, who we all know, especially from the COVID vaccine research and commercialization they've done, so that Pfizer works on gene therapy as well. They're actually using the AAV9 vector to take an approach in Duchenne muscular dystrophy also. So, great initial validation of AAV9, our NAV technology in the technology platform. It's become, I think, one of To me, one of the most amazing products in the history of biotech. It really is something that takes on a nearly curative proportion in children in a very, very difficult disease that had no treatments, that had a very, very high mortality rate, very, very young children, something that can make you very emotional to speak about it. It literally was providing what I would consider to be a near cure for children. So applying that notion of that technology that can do something like that in other areas is meaningful. And so we've got Pfizer and us who will probably file for licenses for products in the next year or two. And then as a company, we've been a lot about sharing our technology through license and through partnership. So I think there are probably a half dozen or more additional programs. I think of a company that we're close with who also licensed our AAV9 vector for a disease called Danon disease. This is a company called Rocket Pharmaceuticals. They also just announced within the last couple of weeks that they've got an alignment with FDA on how to run a 12-patient study to support a potential approval, something that we hope can happen very quickly. And for this indication, which is kind of a hereditary cardiomyopathy-based disease. So, as I'm talking about it, I'm getting even more excited because I think, clearly, the SMA AAV9 experience was a stepping stone. And here I am talking about three specific other programs, our work in Hunter, work in Duchenne, Rocket's work in Danon disease, where that's the exponential growth that I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about scalability with consistent yield and product purity. So they're important factors for gene therapy manufacturing, but they really aren't easily achieved. And so I'd love to hear from you from a broad sort of overarching perspective. What are some of the most maybe cost-effective and but more promising ways to scale with consistent yield and still retain product purity?
Yeah, it's such a great question because when I think about the maturation of production of AAV in the field, I can tell you, I mean, I got involved in gene therapy and was involved in the formation of Regenxbio, which happened around 2009, and the entire field wasn't much of a field when it came to industry. I mean, there were a few outposts in some large companies that were doing some work. Genzyme comes to mind, for instance, at that moment in time. But most of the, what I consider to be, translational research or, drug development work was actually happening in academic settings. And therefore, the production was happening in academic settings as well. And the production was using academic reagents and academic tools, just based on resources and familiarity and availability. And for those of us, I mean, I have a degree in chemistry and I've worked in biotech labs in different forms, including in process development and purification. It's very different when you have to pour your own gels and sort of manage your and create your own tools than when you could have an industrial setting where you can take advantage of innovations in technology. And that's a big difference in scale. So the first step, what I'm alluding to here, is that we needed to get out from under the kind of academic tools and into what is more state of the art for basic biotech to begin with. And that took half a decade, honestly, to kind of take some of those, because when you're already getting reasonable material that is being accepted for investigational new drug applications to begin with, the other thing you need to be careful of is you don't want to make a lot of changes, because as soon as you start to make changes, you may get advice from regulators to go back and rerun studies or sort of start things over. And I've seen that affect how things have been executed on in early stage AAV drug development. For instance, as I alluded to, some of those first drug approvals, they're based on manufacturing technologies that are not scalable. It's probably okay because they're just meant for a really small number of patients. And they're also priced really high in terms of reimbursement costs. You can deal with things that are slower to make, but maybe have good purity, but are more expensive. But as the field has moved forward and we start talking about indications like Duchenne or certainly wet age-related macular degeneration or age-related macular degeneration in general, we have a different set of requirements. And there, so we needed fundamental biotech industry technology to begin with. And then we needed the smart scientists to come in and make improvements to the tools that existed. We needed re new reagents like affinity reagents that were designed in purification to be specific for AAV. There were a lot of affinity reagents out there for traditional biologics and for, again, monoclonal antibody-based technologies, but not for AAV-based products. And so and you saw a lot of collaboration between the industrial reagent companies and companies like Regenix to create some of those things and then share them, make them more widely available to people. We needed more work and investment in the tools that existed and sort of assembling them into end-to-end, kind of industrial environments for manufacturing. At Regenix Bio, our approach was we worked with outside vendors for a pretty long period of time, probably from like 2015 to the early 2020s, on just how to make and install improvements and with things that existed. And we learned a lot. We changed out a lot of equipment. We changed out a lot of the reagents and sort of other downstream tools from the big reactor-based equipment that was at the front of the process. And then we built our own facility and basically installed everything that we had learned in a really state-of-the-art process that I think is one of the most efficient, high-yielding, highest quality manufacturing facilities for AAV anywhere. But think about that. I mean, that was like 7, 8 years of trial and error investment, leveraging other knowledge, our own internal expertise, recruiting a lot of scientific expertise, engineering expertise. This was not something that could be installed overnight, that was off the shelf. It was new investment. It's clearly paying off because I actually see the FDA is starting to raise the bar a little bit because it can, because people are doing better work, have better yields, have higher quality product. They could be a bit more forgiving in the early days of AAV gene therapy, especially in high unmet need areas, to let some of the first generation technologies support products in the market. But what we're doing now at Regenix Bio, I think how regulators are looking at things and how kind of the clinical and patient communities should be looking at things is we're operating at scales and yields and quality that in my view, are appropriately so as good as where biologics and monoclonal antibodies have navigated to as well. And I'm really proud of the industry to have achieved that and made that type of investment. And it's because it's foundationally important for how we're going to, again, achieve that exponential scale.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that detailed response. It's really helpful for our listeners. And certainly, we cover this topic quite frequently on Cell and Gene. And so, manufacturing and scale is probably one of the topics we cover most and what we know our readers want to learn more about. So, this was helpful. I know we covered it a little bit, earlier in our discussion here, but when it comes to 2024, what does it look like for REGENXBIO? I know we have Duchenne, we talked about Hunter, we've certainly talked about your partnership with Rocket, but if you had to kind of look ahead in the next 12 to 24 months, what's on the docket for you guys?
Yeah, well, 2024 is a big setup for a strategy and a plan that we announced a few years ago that we call 5x25. And our goal by 2025 was to have five of our internal or partnered programs using our technology or being executed on directly by REGENXBIO in late stage development or commercialized by 2025. So we talked about that. 2019 was that first approval in spinal muscular atrophy. That product, it's a given. It's already, part of the market ethos. It's treating, thousands of children with spinal muscular atrophy since launch. We want more. So there'll be three programs that are in late stage development in 2024 at REGENXBIO based on our guidance. We're already running a pivotal trial, two pivotal trials, in fact, in wet age-related macular degeneration. We're doing that in partnership with AbbVie. That was the deal that we announced in the end of 2021. And we brought them in to sort of bolster our investment in the globalization of, again, this product potential that is for millions of patients and not just where our footprint started in the United States, but throughout the entirety of Europe, Asia, and beyond. We needed a global partner there. So that'll keep working. We're planning to file our BLA for Hunter syndrome in 2024. And then we just announced yesterday, the day before, that our Duchenne program, we have plans to transition it into pivotal phase in 2024. So we're a company now that has gone from starting in 2008, going public in 2015 with the intent to raise enough capital to bring treatments ourselves to as many patients as possible, but not having anything exactly in the clinic at that moment, to being a company in 2024 that will have at least three of its own programs in late phase of development, one of which we expect to have filed for licensure. And then we have these partnerships, and Rocket also announced that they'll be initiating a pivotal trial very soon. So, I think we see that exponential growth happening. We see REGENXBIO being a late stage clinical development company nearing the prospect of providing product and our product candidates to patients commercially.
Oh, and that's the best part, right? You're going to be affecting all of these lives and really providing hope to the people who are relying on you to do so. So that's wonderful.
It's going to be so satisfying, Aaron. I have to tell you. I mean, we just in the last week, I've engaged a lot with patient communities. We've had the World Muscle Society meeting happening this week, which, while it is an academic and industry conference, the Duchenne community is so present from a patient advocacy family perspective. This past week and weekend, we had the MPS family conference that was actually here in our backyard in Maryland, in Bethesda, Maryland, just a couple miles from our headquarters here. We had some of the families come out to our headquarters here in Rockville, some of the children that are affected by these conditions, like our Hunter syndrome program, Hurler syndrome, to get to show them that we were making the medicine here in the building that was part of our clinical trials and part of the plans we have for our BLA filing next year. And then next week we have a Retina Society meeting. So I'll be going and interacting with a number of the physicians that are part of our wet age-related macular degeneration program and talking more with them about the effect that it's having on their clinics and on their people and the potential and the hope for gene therapy. So it's been a really rich couple of weeks for me engaging with the patient and family communities and the caregiver communities around these diseases. It literally for me is the most satisfying part.
Oh, 100%. I couldn't agree more. It almost like gives you chills. And so thank you for all the work that you're doing on each and every one of those, rare and not so rare diseases that are, we're going to be hopefully curing here in no time soon and offering real hope for patients. I wanted to, so we're at kind of at the formal end of our discussion here. And so at the end of the episode, I like to talk to my guests about who they are when they're not making, producing, manufacturing life-saving therapies for patients who need them. So, you're in Maryland. I'm in Pennsylvania, and so even though the temperatures right now are not letting us think it's fall, it's fall. And was just wanted to know what you and your family and friends like to do at this time of year. Are you football, fall fests, apple picking, just outdoors in general? Not at all. What do you like to do?
Yeah, historically, I mean, it has been, a great period to get outside even more. And we're definitely usually in and about this time, heading out to the pumpkin patches around here, usually the apple picking. It's a little bit warmer down here than where I grew up in upstate New York. So, that's sort of frame shifted a little bit. I've got, two teenagers, both of which that are in high school. So they're also all over the place with activities that usually include sports and dance, and we root for currently unnamed football teams that are struggling a little bit in some of the professional environments. But yeah, no, we're big on the outdoors. We're big on sports, and tends to be fall is an opportunity to kind of reconnect with that as school is starting again for them and they're seeing their friends again. It's always a great time to sort of connect with family on the weekends.
Yeah, for sure. And to you have a little bit more structure. The summer tends to be a little fast and loose, which is great, but then you have the structure of the school year and the organized activities after school and on the weekends and fitting in all that family stuff, because my children are almost the same ages, and I find that keenly aware that before long this isn't going to be what we're doing on the weekends, right? Because they're probably not going to be here. So we enjoy all the same things you do and the organized chaos that comes along with it. So,
That's a great way to refer to it. Yeah.
all right, listeners, that wraps up this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast. Thank you for your time and for tuning in while I talked to REGENXBIO's Ken Mills. Ken, thank you so much for your time. This was a lot of fun and a lot of great information that you shared. So we appreciate it.
Thanks, Aaron. I appreciate the invite and really enjoyed the discussion.
And listeners, be sure to visit cellandgene.com, register for our e-newsletter, and to subscribe to this podcast. We'll talk to you soon.